Welcome, everybody, to the Daily Friend Rap Show. My name is Makoni Maja. I'm going to be your host for today, as well as for tomorrow, since unfortunately Nicholas suffered a bit of an accident. But I'm not here alone. I'm joined by my colleague, Herman Pretorius, over at the IRR. We're going to jump straight into the stories for the day, starting with one of our own, actually. We released it through a PR where we recap the events of yesterday, wherein we hosted a launch of one of our proposals to eradicating many of the issues our economy is currently plagued with. This proposal is part of the What South Africa campaign that we are hosting in the IRR, and it is through a policy proposal, namely the Freedom from Poverty Bill. So, during yesterday's webinar, I got to interview Anthea, who co-authored this Freedom from Poverty Bill alongside our very own guest, Herman. And in it, they codify the alternative to BEE, which has just been a groundbreaking invention in terms of providing solutions and breaking, you know, the stealthy policy environment where for the last 30 years, we've just been circulating, you know, ANC policies, testing them out and failing along as we fail along, doubling down. This Freedom from Poverty Bill and the EED that it proposes, the economic empowerment for the disadvantaged, are a crucial breakaway from, you know, that race-based empowerment framework that has governed and ruled over South Africa for the last 20 years in three critical ways. Herman, do you mind taking us through them? I know the first one is that it's through non-racial empowerment, where BEE uses race as a proxy for empowerment, EED uses means testing, so that even poor people of other races than Black can also benefit. But obviously, since the majority of poor people in South Africa are Black, the majority of the benefit still goes to them. I know the second one is voluntary and incentive-based point system. So EED gets rid of the BE point system, which really places emphasis on management positions and, you know, ownership in companies, and is not voluntary in the sense that if you don't comply with that BEE scorecard, then you can't obviously participate in state procurement contracts. EED gets rid of that system where it doesn't punish companies who do not comply with it. Instead, it encourages them to through incentives. So as you take the BEE scorecard with your company demonstrating how you're contributing to economic growth, you get these points that in the end you'll be rewarded a prize for, right? And the last one is the voucher system, health and education vouchers. I know you can do this better justice than me. I'm just rushing through the points to highlight them. You can go with any one of those points and give us your breakdown and your analysis.
No, I think you did it more than justice. You sell yourself a bit short. So the idea of EED is that there's a difference between real transformation and fake transformation. Fake transformation is window dressing. It is dressing up privilege, but with a black face. It is sort of rigging the numbers at the top so that the virtue can be so signaled. And it is what led Professor William Gumede to calculate that the result of these policies, specifically policies like BEE, has actually been that R1 trillion has been circulated and recirculated between about 100 individuals at the top of the South African political elite hierarchy. That's it. It's not real transformation. People haven't been transformed from having no aspirations to having aspirations, from having no economic participation to having it, from having no opportunities to having it, from having no skills upliftment to having it. It's really just window dressing. It is based on this idea that Black people in Shoshanguve should feel less poor when a Black person in Sandton becomes a millionaire. And there's something quite sinister and quite devious about using the smokescreen of very real grievances to just run this enrichment scheme for the elites that fake transformation has become. So what does real transformation look like? Well, firstly, it must be non-racial. That's the whole point of the new constitution was to move away from this idea of there's some sort of racial hierarchy in politics and in the economy and in society. And then secondly, it is, as you say, voluntary. And the point is that BEE currently is coercive. Employment equity is coercive. It might, in a technical sense, be voluntary. But in the realistic sense, if you want to be a South African business of a certain size, of a certain capacity, of a certain sector, you can't not indulge in these racial hierarchy programs where BEE is coercive, EED is voluntary. It's saying, look, the state isn't going to tell you how to run your business, but we are going to acknowledge when you get it right. And one of the key differences between BEE and EED is BEE picks winners and losers based on political agendas. EED is simply an accreditation, an acknowledgement of good, constructive, pro-growth corporate citizenship. Someone getting an EED scorecard, an EED certificate, won't now have the same sort of BEE conniving access to trade on the certificate. No, it'll just be an acknowledgement officially by the government, by the state, to say that this is a good corporate citizen. They adhere to what good corporate citizenship is, not in the political sense, but in the socioeconomic sense, in the sense that they have a real empowerment, sustainability of employment, upskilling, profits, tax fairness, all of those good stuff. So it is very different from BEE in the sense that it's not a thumb on any scale. It is simply an acknowledgement that there is something like good corporate citizenship, and there is something like BEE, which is coercive and not good corporate citizenship. And then finally, it actually isn't elite-based, EED. It takes the resources currently collected and allocated and spent by the government and puts them in the hands of ordinary people. It doesn't pretend to know what you need for empowerment. That's why school vouchers, housing vouchers, and healthcare vouchers are such a potent and important part and a popular part of EED. The polling we published in May this year indicates that a vast majority, 76% of South Africans, agree that the current empowerment, tenderpreneurship, BEE, employment equity-based system won't help South Africans get ahead. Vouchers for schooling, housing, and education, for schooling, housing, and healthcare will. And that's what the Freedom from Poverty Bill is meant to codify and entrench. It's meant to show this doesn't have to be abstract. This doesn't have to be some dream, some desire. It can be made very real and simple. And that's why I think your webinar yesterday with Anthea were so stupendous, because EED is a project that Anthea has been shepherding and sort of designing within the IRR for a decade. And to see it reach this point of maturity, of readiness, is just quite encouraging. And I would urge everyone to go and look at that webinar online. You've got Makona, you've got Anthea. I mean, what more do you want in terms of unpacking this policy and showing why it matters?
Yeah, I struggle to find even just one person who, you know, isn't interested in the proposals of EED, because finally we can actually target people on the basis of their socioeconomic status rather than, you know, through their declared loyalty to various political entities in South Africa who have had such a stronghold on the economy and have dominated the economy through inverted means. But yeah, I'll link the webinar in our description for those of you who are interested. It's on YouTube, so you can go check it out there. We're going to move on to our next story, which I couldn't have anticipated would have snowballed to this extent. We've covered it now for 3 days in a row. It's about this Emma Powell story after she exposed that the South African Special Envoy, Debisi Jonas's appointment to the United States by President Ramaphosa to represent us as an ambassador there. After the president came out and confirmed that, you know, this is the person that will be replacing former ambassador Rasool, He has actually, it appears, not set foot, Mr. Jonas, not set foot in the United States, not able been able to represent us, because apparently, according to Emma Powell, the United States Dem administration has rejected him and rejected his credentials. Yesterday's story covered the parts of it where the presidency responds and accuses Ms. Powell of embarrassing and belittling the country by, going to the United States as a part of a coordinated, open quote, right-wing nexus attempt to undermine South Africa's development of its own policies and attempts to, draw in these foreign powers to influence South Africa's foreign policy. And now there's a new report that has apparently been handed to South Africa's National Security Council, the NSC, which was chaired by none other than the president, in which it details that Ms. Powell, during her trip to the US, undermined South Africa's open quote, international relations and domestic policy narratives by spreading disinformation that contributed, they say, to negative perceptions of South Africa's foreign policy. It is nearly unthinkable. This is also covered by Soweto, and I'm reading directly from their article. Herman, you released a PR today. I think also just being aghast by the actions the government has taken to double down on its now botched cover up of this information about Mr. Jonas and whether or not he's actually been welcomed by the Trump administration. In your PR, it's titled "Opposing the Expropriation Act is Not Treasonous, Supporting It Is." Tell us more about your analysis there.
Yeah, so what struck me about this is not the fact that it's part of the Jonas controversy. Now, of course, it is perceived as that by Powell herself. And the fact that he has been, seemingly unsuccessful to engage with the Trump administration, without the proper diplomatic credentials that might put someone like him in a position of engagement as an envoy. What struck me about this story is the fact that quite a new and sinister component has been added to this. Not so much, what was the motivation behind this, and is it fair that Jonas was not allowed as Powell suspects, but the fact that the National Security Council, a critical entity in our government, looking after some of the most sensitive issues in terms of national security, found it worthwhile to essentially spy on a member of a political party elected to parliament, and then imply that because she and her party have expressed opposition to the Expropriation Act, they are undermining the South African national interest, and that that is somehow treasonous. And that's a very, very significant thing. The noise and the political context of what this might be retribution for, besides, we here have a situation where we've got an act of parliament that's been signed by the president that risks immense harm to the South African economy, that is opposed by a majority of South Africans. 68% of South Africans oppose the Expropriation Act. Ironically, 79% of ANC voters oppose this act. So opposing it isn't some fringe anti-South African interest. If opposing the Expropriation Act and telling the truth about it, that it is an economic time bomb placed beneath the car of South Africa, then most South Africans are guilty of this treason. Then the IRR is guilty of this treason. And we will remain guilty of this treason if that is what it is, because this act is intensely damaging, intensely dangerous. And telling the truth about it is not disinformation. It is an act of patriotism. It is an act of honesty. And it is quite frankly the case that if you are for the Expropriation Act, if you are either lying about its content or honest about its content, and you like the destruction that its content will bring, then I'm afraid the case for that being treasonous and against the national interests of South Africa is far greater than it is in terms of pointing out the significant dangers, the flaws. And to my mind, it is astonishing that the National Security Council can use the South African media in this way, can use the Sowetan in this way, that the Sowetan can allow themselves to be used in this way as sort of an instrument of state will and chilling political discussion by elected members of parliament. And I just think it's astonishing. And as I say in the press release, in the PR, that the possibility of this reeks of the sort of state entitlement and political abuse and paranoia that fed the mania of the apartheid era security state. This idea that if you're against our policy, you're against South Africa. I mean, that is apartheid psychological thinking 101. It is sinister. It is surprising. And I, for one, will be keeping a very, very close eye on this, especially how the Sowetan responds, because their journalistic integrity now really hinges on whether they can justify this type of reporting, which I think is shameful.
Yeah, this idea that South African state resources can be weaponized, you know, to spy on South Africans, let alone members of parliament who are obviously elected by South African citizens, it beggars belief, and it's a very perverted use of state resources to clearly advance the ANC side of the GNU's aims and objectives. The DA is a partner within the GNU, but obviously they still have their own autonomy. They should be allowed to vary from ANC.
Emma Powell isn't a member of the government. The GNU doesn't mean all DA members of parliament are now ANC members of parliament. The DA, the GNU, the support given to the executive and the multi-party cabinet doesn't mean that politicians and parliamentarians no longer have the freedom that they had. She is still an ordinary member of parliament. She might sit on the other side of the house, but she's not a member of the government. She's an elected member of parliament. And the fact that she cannot, if that is the case, but we are not privy to her conversations, but if she cannot oppose a law that quite clearly her party opposed in the previous parliamentary term, and without triggering some sort of allegation of anti-South African treason, it is absurd. And it just shows the type of thinking that the ANC inherited from the National Party.
Very good. Very well said. On our last story, we'll be discussing the by-elections that were held yesterday. They are three, which particularly struck me as somewhat impressive. The first one was in Sishego Zone 1. In Polokwane, where Julius Malema's EFF in his home ward managed to beat the ANC by 966 votes. They've extended their lead there. In the previous by-elections, they got 51% support, where the ANC got 47% support. And now they've almost, you know, exchanged positions. Or rather, the EFF has extended its lead by 6 percentage points, and the ANC has reduced its support also by 6 percentage points. And then the second one was in Abaqulusi in Zululand, and there the IFP came out as a majority party with 51% of the votes, the ANC with 21% of the votes, and the MK in third place with 19% of the votes. The last one was the DA holding its Ward 34 in Arcadia in Bethelsdorp in Nelson Mandela Bay. What's particularly impressive about this one, I think, having our rule breakers author, that's Herman's book, in which he discusses the last election, is the PA's performance here, which in the last election, I believe they got 3%, and now they've got 43% against the DA's 47%, where in the previous by-election, it appears the DA had 62% support. So the DA still holds that ward there, but my word, has the Patriotic Alliance's support grown immensely. What do you take away from all these, or whichever one you choose to speak on?
So I think these three are the right ones to look at. There was a fourth one in the Eastern Cape, not quite as interesting. But what the first thing that struck me about these by-elections is the high turnout rate. These are really competitive by-elections. Usually, when you have your local government election cycle end, you get your highest level of local government turnout. Most people turn out to vote for who's their local councillor and their PR councillors and representatives and so on. And then, quite often, if there's a by-election, if a ward councillor retires, or if in KZN, gets killed, that's very morbid, but it's unfortunately quite common. Then there's a by-election, and the turnout isn't that high. But in all three of these cases, turnout was very close to what it had been in the Seshego Zone 1, Juju Valley, Mpolokwane. Turnout 51%. To where it was 49%. In Arcadia Bethelsdorp, 47% turnout, where it was 48% turnout. And then in Abakhulusi Zululand, it was 55% turnout, where it was 53. So the first thing to note is that these are very competitive by-elections. Then what's interesting about the first one, the EFF one, is how the EFF's national picture seems to be quite dire. They seem to have fallen to about 5% and even lower nationally. And yet they do better than MK in the set of by-elections, where MK in the Abakhulusi by-election, where they had won 41% of that ward a year ago when it was just the sort of provincial national elections, they fell to 19%. So you've got the EFF. National picture, very dire. Local picture seems to be fine, seems to be stable on the up in that particular ward, ANC on the down. Then you've got MK going from 41% in that ward. Now it was a different election, but it's still useful to compare, down to 19%. That should worry MK immensely. If you can't contest by-elections, you are set up to fail for the coming local government elections. We're judging to be early 2027. But then the by-election that should strike heart into that should strike terror into the heart of the DA is that Nelson Mandela Bay by-election, where the PA went from 3% to 43%. And in my book, I write about how and why the PA grew their vote between 2019 and 2024 by almost 5,000%. We seem to be in sort of impressive PA surge territory. Now, the DA held on to it just down from 62 to 47%. But that's not in the Western Cape, so it's not, the heartland of the so-called national coloured vote, the nationalist coloured vote. It's quite in the Nelson Mandela Bay area, where the DA hopes to do well in the coming local government elections. If this is a sign of things to come, that they could lose 15 points and the PA could pick up 40, then there's some interesting battles around the corner in terms of the DA maintaining its foothold. So ANC, bad news. MK, bad news. DA, worrying news. EFF, a surprising sort of spark of good news for them. These by-elections continue to remain fascinating stuff.
Yeah, sorry, I think I botched those results, but you came right back and rounded them up for us nicely. By-elections are a very important indicator, especially as we're approaching those local government elections. I think we'll be keeping a closer eye on them in our reporting. But for people who are interested in still understanding just what happened in last year's watershed elections, grab a copy of Hadamard's book, Rule Breakers. I believe you have a launch soon. And
Yes. The 26th of July here, we'll have an event in Pretoria and Hatfield, where I'll be speaking to Gert van der Westhuizen, the political editor of Nuus24. So yeah, no, the details are on my Twitter feed, on Facebook. I'll share them again here. But yeah, no, thanks for the promotion, Makoni. I won't say no.
We'll plug the launch details in the description as well for people who are interested in the webinar and Hadamard's book, Rule Breakers. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We hope you found the show to be informative. We will be back tomorrow with a longer form Daily French show. But for now, till then, that's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us.